More Russian meddling today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The midterms are tomorrow, and here's one concern for anybody planning to disrupt the 2020 election. Tomorrow could be the perfect opportunity to practice some new moves.
The midterm elections are kind of spring training for the Russians.
We'll hear what exactly that could mean. Plus, immigration and voter suppression concerns have been big factors in the Georgia governor's race, and that's brought many Latinos over to the Democratic Party's candidate, Stacey Abrams.
I want to say anti-blackness is very real in our community, and I don't want to minimize that, but people are like, oh no, she understands what it's like to be a brown person in the South.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. It is election eve. No surprise what our top story is. Midterms are often a snooze unless you're a party activist or political wonk. Tomorrow is different, though. Not only is control of Congress up for grabs, immigration has been President Trump's go-to topic to fire up his base, and there have been serious concerns about voter suppression in several states. One race where both of those things have been a part of the story is Georgia's governor's contest. The World's Rupa Shenoy has more from Atlanta.
Atlanta's the city where Martin Luther King was born. It was the backdrop for important moments in the American Civil Rights Movement. But Georgia is also home to the largest Confederate monument in the U.S. And to add to the complexity, it now has one of the fastest-growing immigrant populations in the country. The current election could be a crossroads. Georgians could elect the first black female governor in American history.
I have a boundless belief in Georgia's future, where more have the opportunity to thrive, and all Georgia families are lifted up.
Democrat Stacey Abrams is a lawyer and novelist who was for many years minority leader of the Georgia House of Representatives. Celebrities have stumped for her. Oprah's recent visit got a lot of attention. President Trump calls Abrams unqualified, and her opponent, Republican Brian Kemp, says she's too extreme. Kemp's Georgia's Secretary of State, and his office oversees elections, but he's refused to step aside for this one. Kemp campaigned with what he called a deportation bus. There was also this commercial.
I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. Yep, I just said that.
Kemp has some Latino support.
Este 6 de noviembre, únete conmigo para votar por Brian Kemp.
That's Art Gallegos in a commercial for Kemp. Gallegos lives in Gainesville, about an hour outside Atlanta, and he sits on the county GOP executive board.
And this is Juanita, my wife. She accompanies me when there's a woman involved.
Gallegos is a pastor who aspires to political office and supports Trump, even though he disagrees with some of what the president says.
After the end of the day, we have to look and view the whole entire picture to say what is the best for our families, our community, our cities, our counties, our state, and our nation.
And Gallegos thinks it would be best if undocumented immigrants waited in line the way his family did. Three of his brothers crossed the Rio Grande to enter the U.S. long ago.
They got their life in order, and they got their legal status in order, and you know now they're U.S. citizens. So you can't tell me that it's not possible.
Some 3,000 people did what Gallegos is saying and recently became citizens. They registered to vote in Georgia, but a state database flagged them as non-citizens. A judge ruled they should still be able to cast ballots with proof of citizenship. Local Democrats and civil rights activists still call it voter suppression. Gallegos says they're intentionally stirring up trouble. And I respond that that sounds like a conspiracy.
Well, it is. It is. And unfortunately, it comes from the left, and it comes from top.
Meanwhile, Democrats have their own concerns about Republicans.
Right now we're looking for Tomas.
Gina Perez is with Gente for Abrams, a group reaching out to Latino voters. She has an app that helps her find Latino Abrams supporters who may need some reminders to actually get to the polls.
Basically, you could figure out like what Latinos, what age, like first generation, second generation,
The app also helps Perez track her volunteers canvassing this Atlanta suburb. One of them, Tomas, looks like he's been at the same house for a while, so she's checking on him.
Some of our crew members have been harassed. We've had incidents where people are Republicans and they hold up our people, and our people, for some of them, it's hard to get out of the situation. Not all of them, it's just like the younger folks.
Tomas turns out to be fine. He'd just gotten to talking. At many homes, the canvassers are welcomed warmly.
Hola.
Chatting at one home, Perez warns some women to prepare to stand in a long line to vote. She says it's unfortunate when people don't make the time. They've forgotten where they came from, Perez says. Or, she acknowledges, some don't want to vote for a black woman.
I want to say anti-blackness is very real in our community, and I don't want to minimize that. But we thought there was going to be more pushback. People were like, oh, no, she understands what it's like to be a brown person in the South. You know, I don't think that our community is oblivious to the history of the South.
And the history of the South includes a long struggle by black Americans.
Hi.
I meet Leo Smith in the glitzy compound of shops and hotels around the Atlanta Braves ballpark. He says black Americans paved the way for immigrants.
Right now, we're having an argument about the 14th Amendment, birthright, citizenship. Well, that amendment was written to make sure that black Americans became fully engaged citizens. And because of the black American struggle, other immigrants throughout the nation have benefited by being considered by birth, citizens of America.
Smith was the Georgia GOP's minority engagement director until this past June. He says the local party got new leadership with a new vision that didn't include him.
Do they have someone doing minority outreach now?
No, actually, and maybe even rightly so.
Smith says maybe community members should be reaching out to voters, not political parties. He won't reveal how he plans to vote, but Smith says this of Stacey Abrams.
I don't believe that a globalist agenda benefit black Americans. And I think there are a lot of black Americans who agree, and I think we will see that she will not get the black turnout that, say, Obama got.
Smith defends Kemp, even though Kemp's office shed thousands of black voters from the rolls for mistakes in their registrations as small as a misplaced hyphen. Smith argues things are still better than they used to be.
The reality is, I can walk into any voting precinct that I have been assigned to with a latte in my hand and a newspaper under my arm and my children safely beside me without fear.
And he says he has that freedom because of civil rights leaders who suffered greatly.
So it would be an insult to them to suggest that the voter suppression tactics used on John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, are the same that are being used against people now and today. They are not.
But at Chapel Hill Baptist Church, after a rally to get out the vote,
not only must we pray, we must vote.
The Reverend Antonio Grissom sees history a different way.
I think of individuals like my late grandmother and others who were civil rights activists, especially in small Georgia towns in rural Georgia, where racism was adamant, and how they really fought for us to have this right. Within that generation, they feel that time is being, you know, taken back.
Grissom says his elders feel like progress made during the civil rights era is being reversed. Mary Pat Hector is standing nearby.
This is suppression. This is what it looks like. This is trying to silence the voice of the new or soon-to-be majority in this country, which are people of color.
Hector's youth director for the civil rights organization National Action Network. She says if Abrams wins, it'll show that diversity is important and government should reflect all people.
A black woman as governor in a southern state, that speaks powers. And I think that would also push back on a lot of the beliefs that the world has on America now due to the election of Donald Trump.
But if Kemp wins, Hector says some people won't be able to believe the election was fair.
I don't think anyone in their right mind would trust the outcome.
And that's the reaction Art Gallegos, the Gainesville Republican, expects.
They are going to be sort of making a fit, just like a kid, like a child in the store, that you tell them, no, you can't have that candy, and yet they throw themselves on the ground, and they start kicking, and they do whatever to get attention, instead of saying, you know what, okay, let's start from page one, let's work.
For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Atlanta, Georgia.
Rupa is in Atlanta with The World's multimedia editor, Stephen Davey, and he's taking over our Instagram for the next few days from Georgia. Follow their reporting on Instagram, at PRI The World. Another question ahead of the midterms is about foreign meddling. And yes, we're talking about Russia.
If you wanted a way to suppress voting, what better way than turn out the lights?
David Sanger is author of The Perfect Weapon, War Sabotage and Fear in the Cyber Age.
The voting machines usually have to be plugged in. The voting places need lights, at least in the evening. And you need to be able to get to the voting place, which means traffic lights have to be running and so forth. So the simplest thing to do to disrupt a vote would be to turn off the power in a particular place. If you did it too broadly, it would be too obvious and you probably would bring about some form of retaliation. But if you do it selectively, you could imagine its utility.
Now, this might sound like another nutty conspiracy theory, but the Russians have done it before in Ukraine. There's evidence, David Sanger says, that they're getting ready to do it here. Early this year, the Department of Homeland Security found that Russians had placed malware in several nuclear plants here in the U.S., also on parts of the electrical grid. Sanger says there are other things that make the voting system in this country vulnerable.
So the most vulnerable parts of the system are the registration systems, because those are outward facing to the general public. You can go into a election database and figure out if you've been registered and where you're supposed to go to vote. So if that's down simply because somebody did a denial of service attack against it, overwhelming it with data, that would be one way to undercut confidence in the elections, because people would say, well, they can't even tell me if I'm registered. We have seen some of these denial of service attacks, very noisy attacks, against counties, individual places that run these databases to figure out, you know, whether you're registered and so forth. And, you know, part of the shocking part of this is that many of the counties don't even have secure websites for this. You know, when you go on a website, you see that little lock in the upper left corner.
Yep.
That indicates that you've got a certain level of security. A lot of counties haven't even invested in that.
How urgently do you think federal authorities have really pushed local districts to get their security together, to get that lock in the upper left-hand part of the screen, as you say?
Well, there's push, but then there are two things missing. One is Congress has not allocated very much money. The second is voting by tradition in the United States is a state-by-state function and locality-by-locality. And a lot of states do not want the federal government messing around in it.
You know, there's the argument that even if there are no intrusions to the physical infrastructure tomorrow, whenever, the election is really already tampered with. It's hacked because many people will wake up Wednesday feeling like if we don't know for sure about any of this, the results will always feel unfair for one reason or another. What do you think about that?
That's the brilliance of information warfare. It's not really to affect the result. It's to affect your confidence. And, you know, so that's issue was lingering with us from 2016. But 2 years later, I can't tell you whether or not those influence campaigns changed the outcome of the votes. Because to do that, you'd have to crawl inside the heads of tens of thousands of Americans who voted in three swing states where it was very close. And in those three states, you'd have to figure out whether the social media actually changed minds. And we simply don't know the answer to that. And it's very hard to ever get to an answer to that.
David Sanger, author of The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. He's also national security correspondent for The New York Times. We caught him on the way to the airport. David, thanks for making time.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up, we hear from a South African who's a U.S. citizen now, and she's super excited to vote for the very first time tomorrow in this country. That's next. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. With so much talk about immigration before the midterms, we put out a call to new citizens, people voting for the first time here in the U.S. One person we heard from is Diolyn Miranda. She lives in Massachusetts and became a citizen this year.
I was born in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. I'm a non-white South African. My parents were not allowed to vote up until 94, that was the first time they were allowed to vote. So it's very personal to me. I feel like you only realize how important voting is once you've had it taken away.
So when you were growing up in South Africa, what did you hear from your parents about voting, about this civic responsibility that they actually were not allowed to have by law?
My parents were very careful to not expose us to racism. We were very sheltered. My parents raised us to not have hate in our hearts, even though they were so oppressed back in the day. We had no idea that there was racism or apartheid going on. I only became aware when I hit high school and we were allowed to go to a white school. That was when I started to understand that whites didn't like non-whites. So I only had my eyes open the older I got.
I mean, there's been so much rhetoric, veiled and unveiled racism leading up to this midterm. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm heartbroken by it. Heartbroken. Absolutely heartbroken. I don't understand. I don't know. When news broke that Trump had mentioned shithole countries, and I'm from a quote-unquote shithole country, my mother was absolutely distraught, and she cried angry tears. How can this man say that, you know?
Have you voted already? Did you early vote, or are you going to cast your ballot tomorrow?
No, I'm voting on Tuesday. I want to feel the full experience. I don't want to vote early. I'm going to see if I can take my son with me and my husband. We're going to do a whole family affair. I'm very excited.
How old is your son?
He's 10 months old.
Yeah, so a little early to be kind of explaining to him the value of voting. Yeah. But I imagine, though, that when he gets older, you will be able to pass on some stories to him about voting for the first time and voting in South Africa and what it means.
I'll express to him that it's very important to vote because your voting rights can be taken away. You don't think it can be taken away, but you never know. Like, everything can be taken away from you. You have to vote. Your vote is so important. If you want anything to change, you have to vote.
Dilly Miranda, first-time voter here in Massachusetts. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We have more great feedback from first-time voters. You can read more at theworld.org. Immigration, healthcare, democracy itself, those are some of the top concerns on the minds of voters during this midterm season. Typically, what is not top of mind for a lot of voters are climate change and the environment. But that might be starting to change. Nathaniel Stinnett heads up the Environmental Voter Project, which looks at how environmentalists vote. I asked him how the organization defines that.
We are focused on people who care so deeply about climate and the environment that they list it as either their number one or their number two priority over all others. So these are really super environmentalists.
Yes, yeah, so that's a small group, I'm imagining, because environmental issues are quite often at the bottom of the list of voter concerns.
Well, you're right that they're often at the bottom of the list of voter concerns. But believe it or not, there are actually a really large number of these super environmentalists who are already registered to vote. They just don't show up in polls of likely voters because they don't show up on election day.
We've
realized, well, there are two answers to that question. We know a little bit of what's going on. Environmentalists are disproportionately made up of young people, African Americans, and Latinos. And those are three demographic groups that historically vote less often than the rest of the population. So part of the reason environmentalists aren't voting is just a demographic correlation. But there's another thing that we really can't explain, and that is even when you only look at young people, environmentalists vote less often than other young people. Or even if you only look at Latinos, environmental Latinos vote less often than other Latinos. So there's something else going on there, and I wish I could tell you what, but we don't know.
For the people you call environmentalists, what's their turnout been for like the last few elections? And tomorrow, what are you expecting?
So in the 2016 presidential election, 69% of registered voters voted, but only 50% of environmentalists did. And if you go back to 2014, the last midterm election, the story was even worse. In 2014, 44% of registered voters voted, but only 21% of environmentalists did. So the environmental movement definitely has a turnout problem, Marco. But as we look forward to Election Day tomorrow, there are some pretty strong signs that that's changing. What we're seeing in early voting data is just, first of all, across the board, early voting is through the roof. We've already had 35 million people vote in the United States, whereas this time in 2014, only 20 million people had voted. But what's really encouraging for the environmental movement is that young people, African Americans, and Latinos are showing stronger early voting numbers than the rest of the population.
What about people, for example, who live in areas devastated by recent natural disasters? I'm thinking Houston or North Carolina. Are they more motivated to vote based on their experiences?
Absolutely. We are seeing in the North Carolina 9th Congressional District that was hit hard by Hurricane Florence, both the Democrat and the Republican are now talking about climate change all the time. And in Florida, it's amazing. In the Florida 26th Congressional District, the National Republican Congressional Committee made an ad attacking the Democrat for taking money from coal employees. It's not every day you see Republicans vilifying the coal industry. And part of the reason they're becoming a higher priority is because these people are feeling the impacts of environmental and climate issues. But we can't cross our fingers and hope that everybody is going to be devastated by climate change. So I also would like to see environmentalists vote more often. And that's why we're focused on that at the Environmental Voter Project.
How does the U.S. compare to other countries' environmental focus? Like, you know, Germany has a Green Party, for example. Does that imply the environment does get more attention? Or a place like the Marshall Islands or the Maldives, where climate change is real and visible, does that mean that voters there are engaged?
You know, it varies dramatically from country to country, and not just because people are feeling different impacts of climate change, but also because people have different forms of government. I think in parliamentary forms of government, there is more room for people who have unique concerns to express them. And that's why in places like Germany and elsewhere in Europe, you have green parties. But one thing holds true across the globe. Where people are disproportionately feeling the impacts of climate change and other environmental issues, they tend to care more about that when it comes time to go to the polls, and politicians respond.
I'm also wondering, for people whose experience doesn't involve climate change or natural disasters, is it just too big of a problem that, you know, it's not going to affect me over the next 48 hours, and they push it aside?
That is certainly the case with a lot of people. The climate crisis is so enormous that it concerns some people and spurs them to action, but it paralyzes other people. And that's why focusing on really small yet impactful actions that we can make is so important. And the act of voting is one of those things. So even if you're paralyzed by the enormity of the climate crisis, taking 15 minutes out of your day to go and fill out your ballot is one of the easiest ways that you can feel empowered and make a difference.
Very well stated. That's our Get Out and Vote PSA for the day. Nathaniel Stennett, Executive Director of the Environmental Voter Project. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. After the Pittsburgh synagogue attack, members of Toronto's Muslim community wanted to show support for their Jewish neighbors, so they helped form rings of peace around synagogues in Toronto.
It's really a warm, heartwarming, very beautiful and symbolic gesture.
That story still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. That's what mining for gold sounds like, and this is what mining cryptocurrency sounds like. Those are computers doing the calculations needed to unlock new digital coins like Bitcoin. It turns out that all digital process, it actually uses more energy than industrial gold mining, a lot more. So says a study out today in the journal Nature Sustainability. Here's The World's Carolyn Beeler.
A couple of years ago, Max Krauss started looking into mining cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin from his apartment. But before long, he learned what others already knew, just how much energy the process would use.
And when I realized that as a scientist, I said, these numbers can't be right.
They seemed really high. So Krauss, who's an environmental engineer in Cincinnati, decided to crunch those numbers himself. He and a co-author analyzed how much energy computers running four top cryptocurrency networks use to unlock or digitally mine new coins. And to put those figures in perspective, he compared them to how much energy it takes to physically mine valuable metals.
It was definitely surprising. We found mining a dollar's worth of Bitcoin consumed three times as much energy as mining a dollar's worth of gold.
which led him to a question.
If we hope to use cryptocurrencies in the future as a separate currency from a dollar or a euro, are we willing to invest this much energy, more energy than, for example, mining gold?
There's a lot of effort going in this area.
David Malone from Ireland's Maynooth University says some cryptocurrency networks are seriously looking at revamping the process miners use to unlock new coins to make it less energy intensive. But he says Bitcoin, the largest network and the most energy intensive in this study, is not among them.
I think the only thing that will reduce the energy usage of Bitcoin itself in the near future is likely to be a crash in value of Bitcoin or something like that.
Max Krause's paper does highlight one reason for optimism. If miners move server farms away from countries with lots of fossil fuel power to countries with lots of renewables, that could lower the overall carbon footprint of mining cryptocurrencies. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Cutting the footprint of a single economic activity? Challenging. Imagine greening the entire global economy. It might be the biggest challenge the planet will ever face. Some countries are doing better than others. Among them is Norway. They're good at a lot of things. But some Norwegians say the country's image as a leader on climate change overshadows some contradictions. And Norway can't help green the global economy without facing up to them. Here's Amy Martin of the Threshold podcast with the latest of our stories on the Arctic and climate change.
This is the sound of a couple thousand extremely happy Norwegians. I'm in the town of Longyearbyen, which is on a Norwegian archipelago called Svalbard. It's way up in the North Atlantic, about halfway between mainland Norway and the North Pole. And it's Norwegian National Day, and people here are celebrating in style.
I love your dress. Does it have a name?
Bunad.
Bunad?
Yeah.
And what is the history behind it?
It's every part of the country has their own bunad, so it sort of shows where you're from.
This is Kari Ellingsen. She's 26, and like many of the women and girls in the parade, she's wearing an old-fashioned dress, embroidered with ornate flowers. Many of the men in the parade are wearing the male version of the bunad, fancy vests, jackets, and short pants, often with big buttons or tassels at the knee. And almost everyone is also carrying a little Norwegian flag, and not just carrying it, waving it enthusiastically, smiling big and spontaneously bursting into cheers. It's a long, jubilant river of red flowing through the snowy streets of this high Arctic town.
I know that some people may think that it's like nationalistic. What's that?
Nationalistic.
Yeah. It's not Norway for Norwegian, but it's like sort of Norway for everyone. And I think it's like a celebration of the human rights and freedom of speech.
The Economist magazine currently ranks Norway as the most democratic country in the world, and Reporters Without Borders also puts it at number one on its World Press Freedom Index. Norway is also among the richest countries in the world, mostly because of its massive offshore oil and gas reserves. But some Norwegians have grown uncomfortable with that.
Why should we just keep pumping up oil and pretending to be moral superior to everyone and going like, oh, we're the happiest people in the world while we're drowning in oil?
This is Iselil Kolpis. She's 27 years old, and she teaches at a high school in the Arctic city of Tromsø, Norway. Just a few days before we met, the Norwegian government had opened up more than 100 new areas for offshore oil and gas exploration.
I don't get it. It's such a bad choice.
Norway doesn't actually use much of what it drills. It meets almost all of its own energy needs with renewables. So it exports the oil and gas and uses the income to provide free healthcare and education and savings for the future. And at the same time, the country has set some very ambitious climate policy goals. For example, they're aiming to phase out the sales of new gas and diesel vehicles by 2025. Iselil supports those initiatives, but she thinks Norway's trying to have it both ways, a reputation for environmental leadership and the fossil fuel wealth. And she says it's time to make a choice.
If we just make the decision and just go, no, no more, we don't open any more oil rigs now, no more fields, no more areas, then we are forcing ourselves to look in the other direction.
For Isalil, one of those other directions is toward her own roots. She's Sami, one of the indigenous people of northern Scandinavia. And she believes that the rest of Norway could learn a lot from the Sami. But, she says, there's a long tradition of ignoring or outright silencing Sami voices.
What is Norway? Yes, Norway is Vikings and farmers and the bunad, everything Norwegian is this. And what did we decide was not Norwegian? Samis.
The Sami are descendants of some of the very first people to enter the Scandinavian peninsula more than 10,000 years ago. They developed 9 different languages and traded with each other across their Arctic homeland, which they call Sápmi. Much more recently, other groups, like the Vikings, migrated into this region from the south. They built kingdoms, which eventually became the nations of Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And as borders went up across Sápmi, Isalil says her ancestors were viewed with suspicion.
There was this thought that to create a nation, you have to have one language. Like, one language, one nation, one people. That means if it's not Norwegian, it doesn't really fit our project right now. It's not that convenient that you have a double identity. You have to choose one, and please choose the Norwegian one.
Sami music and spiritual traditions were declared sinful, and Sami children were forced to attend boarding schools. It was a colonization and Christianization process that will sound painfully familiar to many Native Americans and other indigenous communities around the world. And it's a legacy that carries on even today. Isalil says when she was growing up, no one in her family talked about the fact that they were Sami.
Yeah, it's such a weird thing because I've always known, because my last name is Kolpus, and that's an old Sami name. So I've always known, and I've always heard my grandmother and my grandfather talking Sami, but I didn't really realize it or understand it until I was 18.
That was when one of her cousins started wearing a gakti, the traditional Sami dress.
And I was like, oh, that's right. We're actually Sami. It's not just a thing like some of us are, but we all are.
Later, Isalil received her own gakti from an elderly relative.
And it's the most beautiful piece of clothing I've ever seen. And I think it's 80 years old, but it's the colors are still so vivid, and I only wear it for the really special occasions.
She started sharing pictures of herself wearing the gakti on social media and sometimes writing posts in Sami. Lots of people were supportive, but not all.
I don't know how annoyed they are, or if it's just a comment in passing, they're just, oh, she saw me now, or something like that, which you hear a lot when you're a part of the Sami population who are reclaiming. You hear a lot, oh, you're Sami now. And you go, no, I've always been Sami.
Sami people are increasingly making themselves seen and heard in all sectors of society. And for Isalil, reclaiming her Sami identity has meant becoming more politically involved, especially around environmental issues.
A lot of people say, oh, you're indigenous and you must be in touch with nature. And yeah, maybe, but I hope that I would care about the same issues even though if I wasn't Sami. it's a fact that a lot of the Sami culture is intertwined with nature, and a lot of our expressions are based in how we used to live very close to nature, and some of us still do.
Isalil says Sami communities are fighting the expansion of mines, railroads, logging operations, and even wind farms on land that they consider to be their ancestral home. And she says many Sami people are very concerned about what's going on offshore, too. Carbon pollution from fossil fuels is directly impacting Sami reindeer herders. The warming Arctic has brought more rain in the winter, and that means more ice, which reindeer can't dig through to get the lichens and plants they need to survive. But Isalil says it's not just rural Sami who are concerned about the impacts of climate change.
Me, I'm what you call a city Sami, or an asphalt Sami. It's the derogatory term. But we have a lot of issues that affect us as a people, as a culture. At the same time, it affects nature. In that way, my Sami identity and the part of me that cares about environment is two sides of the same story.
I'm now at a Sami community center tucked into the forest in the mountains of northern Norway, A group of women have gathered here to make food for a festival called Markumenu. It's an annual celebration of Sami culture, and Susanna Amalia Longstrand Andersen is its producer.
I have been traveling to a lot of international UN meetings, and I always get the question, are you really indigenous because I'm white? But I am. And
That's interesting. Who asks you that?
Other indigenous people. And I can understand them because they have a different story about colonization.
Like Isilil, Susanna Amalia often wears the gakti, but when she's not wearing it, she could be mistaken for any other Norwegian. This is one of the complexities of being Sami. You can hide your heritage if you want to. You can blend in. And in her family, as in Isilil's, there was a lot of pressure to do so, especially for the older generations.
Like my grandmother, she has never really said that we are not Sami. But 10 years ago when we went to the store, she would not speak Sami in the store in any way because other people could hear us speak Sami.
But things are changing. Susanna Amalia says her generation is determined to take Sami culture out of the shadows.
There are really a fighting spirit in Sápmi now, and you see that through art and music, that most of the art and music is about that we are still here. It's very political, most of the art and the music and nearly every cultural expression right now.
And Susanna Amalia says as her peers reclaim their Sami identity, many of them see their situation in a global context. They're connecting with other indigenous movements, like the anti-pipeline protesters at Standing Rock in the United States. There are also Sami parliaments in all four countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia, with varying degrees of power.
We have information about the entire planet, and that demands of us that we change the way we think and that we learn to think holistically.
This is Anna Henrietta Reynas Nilud. She's 24 years old, and she's the youngest member of the Sami Parliament of Norway. She carries around a MacBook bearing a sticker with a Sami version of Rosie the Riveter.
People think that indigenous people and Sami people are something we read about in the history book, but it's not. It's so important to let indigenous people of the world tell the rest of the world how to live with nature instead of against nature.
For example, Anna Henrietta says instead of fixating on our national identities, we need to start thinking of ourselves as one species with common interests and a shared fate.
This nationality, this way this world is organized, that too does not fit with the indigenous thought, in my opinion, because I think that we are people, we are living on a planet, we have different ways of living, but none of us are above or superior to another group of people.
This is not to say Anna Henrietta believes the Sami have all the answers. She says just like any other group of people, there's great diversity of opinion and approach within the Sami community, and she warns against reducing the Sami or any indigenous group to some kind of mystical heroes who are going to save the rest of us from environmental disaster with their ancient wisdom. Her message is way more practical than that.
Just look around you. The big society is clearly not doing a great job taking care of this planet. Of course we should listen to indigenous people.
For Anna Henrietta, being indigenous is as much about building the future as it is about honoring the past. She says it's foolish to think we're going to solve climate change using the same ways of thinking that created the problem. In her opinion, we have to open up to other worldviews.
And this holistic way of thinking that is very much alive in the indigenous groups, I think that's the only way forward.
For the world, Amy Martin, Northern Norway.
Amy's reporting is from our partnership with the Threshold podcast and radio program with funding support from the Pulitzer Center. You can listen to Amy's stories about the Arctic and climate change at theworld.org/thebigmelt. Last Friday night through Saturday, people across this country showed up at synagogues for Shabbat services. Lots of people, Jews and non-Jews, showing support after the tragedy at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. 11 people shot and killed during the previous Saturday's worship, 6 more injured. Among those to respond quickly in Pittsburgh were Muslims. One effort pulled in $230,000 to help victims and grieving families.
We're not going to stop. We don't think our work is finished because that's a high number. We just want to know what you need. You know, if it's more money, let us know. If it's people outside your next service, you know, protecting you, let us know. We'll be there.
That was Wase Muhammad, executive director of the Pittsburgh Islamic Center, speaking last Sunday at a vigil for the victims. Religious groups all over the globe have been uniting in prayer and mourning along with the Tree of Life community. This was the case up in Canada, in Toronto.
Jews in Toronto went back to temple this morning, and members of other faith communities came out to show their support.
People of all faiths gathered outside, standing shoulder to shoulder.
To take part in a ring of peace, joining hands to show solidarity for victims of the mass shooting at a Pittsburgh synagogue a week ago.
Fatima Sajjan is with the National Council of Canadian Muslims. She helped organize the Rings of Peace effort. Tell us, first of all, what is a Ring of Peace?
So a Ring of Peace is a symbolic gesture showing people that in order to get through the synagogue, you have to go through us. So it's essentially like a human chain where we all link arms. It's quite a warm feeling.
Yeah. How did this idea come about?
After the attack at the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh, it felt so close to home for the Muslim community. In light of the Quebec City mosque shooting that happened almost 2 years ago, we felt like we really needed to do something. We recalled how we were hurting so much close to 2 years ago, and our Jewish brothers and sisters wanted to offer some comfort. So they formed a Ring of Peace.
So after that shooting in Quebec City, Jewish groups did a similar Rings of Peace effort. It's my understanding that they got the idea from Europe. So what's going on here? It sounds like a pay it forward kind of thing going on.
That's right. Yeah, it seems like it's a really strong message you're communicating to people. So yes, it's true. The idea came from Europe, and then the Jewish communities did it 2 years ago, and then we did it this past weekend. We had more than 15 Muslim organizations and mosques come on board, as well as some interfaith groups, because really it wasn't about just one particular faith group, but it was a humanitarian support.
So set the scene for us. What was it like taking part in these Rings of Peace outside synagogues across Toronto? What did you see?
At the synagogues, people were surprised to see us and at the same time so comforted. What was meant to be a very silent gesture instead turned into a few conversations with our Jewish brothers and sisters about how they felt. And our hearts were full of love and respect for each other. And the conversation about tolerance came up. And we're like, yeah, tolerance is a garbage word. Because really, you're just tolerating each other. Like, we need to love and respect each other. And we also need to talk about how did this attack happen? What led to this? And what are we going to do together?
I hear there's also singing. What were people singing?
Yeah, so at the Holy Blossom, so Holy Blossom was, I'm not sure if you know, one of the victims, she was raised in Toronto, and she was a member of the Holy Blossom Temple. So
right. Joyce Feinberg, her name.
Yes, that's right. So we arranged for three mosques to head down to Holy Blossom. They went down, and then they sang a religious chant, something that was taught by our Holy Prophet.
All of these Rings of Peace must have been really moving, but that one at Holy Blossom Temple, given that Joyce Feinberg was one of the victims in the Pittsburgh shooting, how emotionally charged was that one?
I think that one felt the most real because it was so close to home for the congregation and also for our communities that were there. It was really comforting. In fact, one of our key organizers, Osman Khan, he was invited inside the Shabbat service to say a few words. Mm. One of our friends, Michael Lublin, gave him his yarmulke to wear for a little while. And I really liked the pluralism. And we really hope that we can keep that going.
Yeah, I mean, I think these Rings of Peace show that tragedy can bring about something positive. But I'm just curious, how often do these different communities of faith actually get together in Toronto?
We have a few organizations. They all do dialogues regularly, but the turnout is not what you'd like it to be. I'm hoping that this is just the beginning of a bigger conversation or a bigger issue where we can come together and address hate crimes, because we're seeing an increase. One community can't face this alone. Hmm. That's why we decided to do this Ring of Peace. We recognize that it's not just up to the Jewish community to solve anti-Semitism. Muslims have to step in. So kind of like we have to step into each other's issues to deal with common forms of hatred.
Well, Rings of Peace seems like a really good start. Fatima Sajjan, a development officer with the NCCM, that's the National Council of Canadian Muslims. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's Mood Music Monday, hashtag World Mood Music. In these moody times, we asked you how your mood is and whether you've got a song to match it, or maybe you found a song to adjust your mood. Tell us, tell me on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. I'm at Marco Werman. Today's request comes to us from Damon Krakowski, who listens to The World right here in Boston on WGBH. It's a track by the Brazilian singer, composer, some would say poet, Chico Buarque. My mood, wrote Damon, is anxious. And why does this track by Chico Buarque help you with your mood? Protest music, Damon says, makes me feel less alone in my political anxieties, a good reminder that it is a collective struggle. So thanks for the request, Damon. This track by Chico Buarque, A Pesar de Você, or In Spite of You, this is a joyous samba, but it echoes many Brazilians' struggle against their right-wing dictatorship in the 1970s. The first line and the chorus go like this. In spite of you, amanhã vai ser outro dia, tomorrow is another day. Apesar de você, amanhã vai ser outro dia. Eu pergunto a você, onde vai se esconder da enorme euforia? Como vai proibir, quando o galo insistir em cantar? Água nova brotando e a gente se amando sem parar. Tomorrow is another day, that's putting it mildly. A Pesar de Você from Chico Buarque, one from the World Mood Music Request Line, courtesy of listener Damon Krukowski. What is your mood? What's your song? Tell us on Twitter, at PRI The World or at Marco Werman. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Back with you, amanhã. Ora tem a fineza de desinventar. Você vai pagar e é dobrado cada lágrima rolada.
PRI, Public Radio International.